To get in and out of the courtroom, including Justice Stacy. Ms. Newell, good morning to you. You may approach.
Can I please report opposing counsel? My name is Sarah Newell. I'm attorney with the Commission on Public Advocacy, here representing Josh Carr. Just for point of clarification, since these cases were consolidated, do I have 10 minutes or 12?
How much would you like?
I'm probably fine with either, but I would defer. I just wanted clarification so I know how much to reserve.
Well, I think we were counting on 10 minutes, but if you need more, just ask.
Okay. If I can reserve 2 minutes. Just for, I guess, we submit that the court erred by determining that there was not a fair and just reason for Mr. Carr to be able to withdraw his plea in this circumstance. Brief review of the facts in this case. Mr. Carr was charged with two separate robbery charges. One was committed on September 11, 2014. With Mr. Nevels, Mr. Scott, and allegedly himself. That was at CR 14-1507. Subsequent charge, which was actually earlier in time, at CR 14-1508, involved an attempted robbery, homicide under a felony murder theory, possession of a stolen firearm, use of a weapon. That involved different co-defendants, allegedly, Adams, Holmes, and Lewis. The issue here is that after a global plea agreement was worked out and a plea was entered, information came forward that suggested that one of the co-defendants in the September 11th robbery, Jamarcus Scott, showed up at the house of another individual with blood on his shirt, saying things like, we fucked up, he's dead. When asked who, he talked about Mo, who was the victim in the August 30th shooting. This information caused Mr. Carr to want to withdraw his plea after a brief period of investigation and depositions regarding the individual who came forward with this information. Mr. Carr filed motions to withdraw both pleas.
Was Mr. Carr present at the time that the factual basis was given for his plea to the murder case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And were those facts presented that would establish the conviction as charged?
Yes, Your Honor. We submit that that is not the relevant inquiry with regard to the fair and just reasons issue. There are separate reasons, or there's a separate analysis for whether or not a plea was entered freely, voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. We submit that the fair and just reasons standard is separate and apart from that. If the two collapse together, there would be no point in having a fair and just reason standard. We submit that the possibility of the potentially exculpatory, newly discovered evidence by itself constitutes a fair and just reason for Mr. Carr to be able to withdraw his plea, and that the court here erred by imposing what is essentially whether the evidence is actually exculpatory.
So it's your position that if there's potentially exculpatory evidence, that a defendant, as a matter of right, should be able to withdraw his plea or her plea?
In a nutshell, I use the term potentially exculpatory because it's certainly shorter than the language that I cited in my brief that I've taken from State v. Kula. I think that the language in State v. Kula is the cleanest way to approach this, which is basically looking at whether or not the new evidence is material to the preparation of the defense. Would it play?
So on the robbery charge, how does the statement help your client? The district court said it wasn't even relevant.
Are you... The robbery charge of 1507?
Yes.
It is not technically exculpatory with regard to the robbery charge of 1507. I think that the robbery charge should be allowed to, I guess the grounds for setting aside the fair and just reason in that context is because it was a global plea, by withdrawing his plea on 1508, that means that the state is going to, I guess it voids the plea agreement, and the state then gets the benefit of the plea agreement on 1507, where the defendant did not. So because it's a global plea agreement, I think the two should be taken together and both should be allowed to be withdrawn.
So your basic argument is, I pled guilty to this, but I find somebody else might be culpable in this, then my plea wasn't voluntarily made because I didn't have all the evidence necessary to form a voluntary opinion to the plea?
Somewhat. I made two different arguments. One is with regard to whether the plea was freely, voluntarily, and intelligently made. And I based that argument on some language that basically suggests that A guilty plea cannot be a conscious, informed choice if the accused relies upon counsel who performs ineffectively. And that kind of, I mean, obviously this isn't an ineffective assistance of counsel case at this point, but the general idea is that if a defendant doesn't have all the information, they can't be making a truly informed choice. I'd like to de-emphasize that argument. I think that the case law is pretty settled. I don't know that you need to approach it under that prong. I think the more appropriate way of approaching it is under the fair and just reasons analysis. So with regard to the fair and just reasons, I'm saying that because there's evidence out there that is newly discovered, that we didn't know at the time that he entered his plea, Mr. Carr has always maintained his innocence. He entered into this plea agreement because he was looking at a potential life sentence, and he is a 19-year-old man. As he indicated in his sentencing comments, you know, I'm 19, there's a bunch of people saying what they're saying against me, you know, I rolled the dice. This is, I think, what also distinguishes this case from Lopez in the sense, which is the unpublished opinion that I cited in the brief. Mr. Carr's always known that he had an alibi defense. The problem is he didn't know that he had any evidence that supported his alibi defense. It was his word against these 5 to 6 other people. Now he knows that there's another person that is saying, yes, someone showed up to my house covered in blood around the time of the shooting and said, we fucked up, Bo's dead. These things change the dynamic because it supports the idea that he has evidence on his side, aside from just his word against them.
And so ultimately what you want is you want to withdraw in both cases, or
yes, because of the nature of the global plea agreement,
that just starts everything all over again.
Well, the statement. What did the court do on the statement from Davis? Was it a jailhouse cellmate that stated you heard the defendant say, "I wasn't the first one to pull the trigger"?
Yes.
So how is that explained? Exculpatory. It seems to me it's incriminating.
Well, that's not exculpatory, and I don't want to use that statement, candidly. But the problem, I mean, that is a problem for us, and we take our witnesses as they come to us. What is interesting, though, is that Mr. Trayshawn Davis was contacted by the court, or by the state, the day after the plea was entered. He was interviewed. And at that point, he said they suspected, apparently, that he had some information about this case. He told them initially about Jamarcus Scott coming to his house covered in blood and making the statements that suggested that he was involved in shooting Mo. While they went to re-interview him, a few days later, he'd been in the same cell block as Mr. Carr and overheard Mr. Carr say something to the effect of, "I'm just saying I didn't shoot first." In investigating that, leading up to the motion to withdraw, we determined that he could not have actually been present in the way that he said that he was, because he wasn't ever let out of the cell block at the same time to be playing cards with those other individuals. It's possible that he overheard some part of the conversation from an adjacent cell block when he was still locked down and the other folks were playing cards, which in my mind, and the way I would explain it to the jury, explains why he got this statement taken out of context or why he misunderstood it. Mr. Freeman, who was present during that conversation, said that is not what Mr. Carr said. Mr. Carr has always maintained his innocence and has actually contradicted people when they've talked about him as though he had shot Mo. So, yes,
but this is your plan on how to minimize that.
Yes.
But going back to the focus of your newly discovered evidence.
Again, the issue here is that we should look at whether the new evidence is material to the preparation of the defense, whether it plays an important role in uncovering admissible evidence, which it could. We only had a month to investigate. Lord knows what else we could find if we actually had time to look into this in more detail. Aiding preparation of witnesses. Obviously, there's more information that can be learned. There's more people that maybe saw Mr. Scott walking from the area covered in blood. There's a lot of other things that we could do that could assist in cross-examining those other witnesses and all the confidential informants, because we now have this information. All of the confidential informants, which is the basis of the information against Mr. Carr, said that Mr. Scott was not involved in this. So the fact that someone places Mr. Scott with blood on him and involved in this crime completely undermines and contradicts all of the state's witnesses. Also, that it corroborates testimony. It corroborates Mr. Carr's alibi, that he was not there, that it was someone else that did the shooting. And it also assists in impeaching and rebuttal, as we discussed before. For these reasons, it's very clear to me that this is that this should constitute a fair and just reason. As I indicated in the brief, under the federal courts, use a much more lenient standard.
Do we still review this as abuse of discretion?
I think you can. I think it's pretty clear that what the judge decided here was that, in his mind, that this evidence wasn't exculpatory because he didn't believe it. And I don't think that that's the appropriate standard. The abuse of discretion standard, I think it is an abuse of discretion to just say, I don't believe you, and that's therefore this isn't exculpatory. Also, the way that he phrased the order, says, fairness and justice require that any newly discovered evidence must at a minimum be exculpatory of the defendant. That is not a standard that I find anywhere in the law. So I think at the very least he abuses discretion by applying the wrong standard.
Well, what does he have to, what does it have to be? Just new and different evidence, or does it have to relate to the guilt of the defendant?
I see that I'm out of time, if I may answer.
No, you may.
It seems to me that you look at what the evidence is and you allow, you take it on its face. You don't evaluate the credibility. Basically, is to determine if this were true and if this were believed, does it change the dynamic?
Well, then that's an automatic get out of jail, isn't it?
Not necessarily. I think there's a variety of different grounds that people assert to try to withdraw their pleas. Like, a lot of them are things like, I changed my mind, I was on different medication. Those don't constitute exculpatory evidence. Those don't constitute a fair and just reason. But if somebody says, somebody came to my door covered in blood, needing a ride out of town, saying I killed somebody, that's something that I think you can take on its face and allow them to withdraw the plea and take it to jury.
Does prejudice to the state come in here at all? Is that?
I don't think it does. The state's argument, which I quite frankly don't understand, is that the folks, all the witnesses have been sentenced, but their plea agreements require them to testify truthfully and give information truthfully. If the state chooses to void their plea agreements because they find that they did not testify truthfully, they can do that and they can go back and recharge those folks at any point. Further, they're not hiding anywhere. They are in custody. All these folks got fairly lengthy sentences. So it is not as though that the state can't find them in the next year or two to go ahead and proceed to prosecution on those folks. I think the only thing that they potentially are out is the idea that those folks didn't get stronger arguments at sentencing.
Well, Scott was the one that's supposed to have showed up covered with blood.
Yes. Right?
And was he sentenced or convicted and sentenced?
Yes, all these folks worked out plea agreements.
For what was he sentenced?
He was sentenced for a series of different things.
Was anything in connection with this killing?
He was sentenced for the robbery at the September 11th robbery, and then a series of, I believe, two other robberies that he was independently involved in that Mr. Carr was not linked to.
But he wasn't sentenced for anything involving this?
Nothing connection. Regarding the August 30th shooting. Everyone has maintained that he was not involved in any way in the August 30th shooting. So that
he being?
Jamarcus Scott, okay. The co-defendant in 1507. So that is why this new evidence is so huge, because it undermines the state's entire case with regard to 1508, if he was there and if he was involved in the shooting.
If one of the witnesses that was convicted and already sentenced, there was a new trial granted, plea withdrawn, go to trial, and the witness testifies differently, it's your view that the state could simply start over? Could it ask for a sentence beyond the sentence which was imposed the first time around?
My understanding of the way that the plea agreements were made is that part of their proffer agreement, part of their cooperation agreement, is that if the state feels at any point that they have lied or they were not honest, that they can move to set aside that conviction. Refile the charges.
You think double jeopardy would permit a sentence in excess of what was given already?
In excess of what was given already?
Yes. In other words, the witness presumably got some benefit out of providing this testimony. And if the witness violates the agreement and is prosecuted, could the witness be sentenced to a greater sentence than originally?
I believe so, because they would be withdrawing the conviction and refiling the charges, essentially. I mean, I'm not using the right language. But
well, I'm probably not either, but do we have a case law that deals with that? I'm a little concerned about the accuracy. Do you have any authority for that proposition?
I don't have anything offhand.
It's sort of collateral to your argument, I understand.
My understanding is that, again, the way that the state views these cases is that the defendant, the co-defendants are essentially waiving their right to challenge those kind of things when they enter the plea. I don't know if that's valid, but that's certainly the way that the state approaches it. All these folks have pled to some kind of charge, a lesser included charge of these crimes.
Is it relevant? I think we're exploring sort of a domino effect because we have, I think, some plea deals based on the idea that Scott's not involved, right? And those would be unwound.
And I guess I would say that it is no different than if this information came forward after he was sentenced and it came forward in a motion for a new trial, or I guess it would be newly discovered evidence, because this is information that came forward later. We just happened to get it at this magical moment of time where, in theory, the standard is a little bit lower. But otherwise, I don't think it would vary in any way from whether or not I were to file a post-conviction motion or whether Mr. Carr were to file a post-conviction motion if we discovered this 10 years down the line.
You think this is more opportune between the plea and the sentence?
Well, it certainly is very convenient that the state found Mr. Davis the day before the plea was entered. I don't say that to imply that there's any wrongdoing on the state's part. It's just the timing. I don't have control over when newly discovered evidence falls in our lap. No further questions. I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Carr's or reverse the district court's decision and allow Mr. Carr to withdraw his plea.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ralph. Good morning again.
May it please the court. My name is Austin Ralph. Represent the state of Nebraska. Primary issue on appeal is whether the district court erred in denying motions to withdraw the pleas before sentencing. Basis for the motion was newly discovered evidence, namely the deposition testimony of one Trayshawn Davis. Our position basically is that there was no error here. The district court applied the correct framework. Its reasoning was sound. It reached the correct conclusion that there was no apparent misreason for the plea. Accordingly, we ask this court to affirm the judgment below. I don't think there's any dispute as to the general legal framework I set forth in the briefs. You've got to have a fair and just reason before sentencing. You also have to show no substantial prejudice to the state. Defendant's burden to prove the fair and just reason by clear and convincing evidence. And there's no right to withdraw a plea, no absolute right. It's simply a discretionary matter of the court. The decision is reviewed for abuse of discretion. I wanted to point out, I think...
So a defendant can withdraw the plea if there was exculpatory evidence, like DNA.
Sure. The fact that there's some level of exculpation, I don't think is necessarily dispositive, but it's certainly, at some point, say, if the DNA conclusively says, obviously, you're not guilty, then yes, you can remove to withdraw your plea. But here, the district court found that it was not exculpatory at all. And I think that is based on sort of an underlying issue is the record presented to the court at the hearing. The only evidence offered was deposition testimony, certain police reports explaining that they interviewed with the guy, the plea agreement, and I forget the other exhibit, but as well as the court judicially noticed the record of the plea hearing, and in particular the factual basis. The court explicitly said, pre-sentence report's not in front of me. I got nothing about cooperating statements. I got nothing about cooperating agreements. It's just the factual basis and the exhibits offered at the hearing on the motion to withdraw the plea. That's, I think, the basis for why the court determined that there's no exculpatory value to this evidence, because, one, the statement at the jail, as Your Honor, stated, was actually inculpatory. He admits to pulling the trigger. But the incident with Scott doesn't do anything in light of that record evidence because the plea, the factual basis, just says it's Carr and three other guys. That's it. We don't know who they are. The only evidence adduced is the factual basis. We don't know the names. We don't know the number of individuals from Scott's statement. Allegedly, he says, you know, we fucked up, he's dead. Well, who's the we? Court didn't know. There's no evidence showing it. And the court said, well, you know, we know that Carr and Scott worked together. They did this robbery over here. And there's nothing exculpating Carr here. It's just inculpating, at most, Scott. So,
excuse me, is this a sense of your argument, then, that the factual basis was sufficient and accurate?
Well, yeah, it was. The factual basis was that it was Carr and three other individuals that did this incident on August 30th.
If Carr is present at that activity,
it
doesn't make any difference who shot him.
Right. I mean, he was on the hook for felony murder originally, and then he got pled down to manslaughter for the homicide. But I guess my point is, the district court, looking at the record that it had before it, said the fact that Scott allegedly said, we fucked up, he's dead, Mo, doesn't exculpate Carr at all, because it's we. And Scott and Carr were known to work together. Nothing eliminating Carr from suspicion, even if it actually inculpated Scott. So I think that the premise that well, it's these other three guys, Adams, Lewis, and Holmes, wasn't presented to the district court based on the record that I saw. And the court explicitly said, all I have is the factual basis and the exhibits offered. I don't think it's an abuse of discretion to decide a case based on the evidence presented to you.
The defendant has a burden of clear and convincing?
Clear and convincing evidence to prove a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea. We submitted and didn't meet that burden. Like I said, the main focus of the motion to withdraw the plea is the deposition testimony, and in particular those two incidents. One, the inculpatory statement at the jail, and the alleged incident with Scott in early September 2014, which, you know, I agree with the district court, doesn't exculpate Carr. Again, based on the record provided. Didn't explain who we was. Scott didn't say any names, number of individuals. The only thing the actual basis showed is that it was Carr and three other guys, and Carr and Scott were known to work together, as evidenced by the plea in the September 11th case. So based on the record before the court, submit no abuse of discretion there. I do think State v. Lopez, unpublished decision, addressed in both briefs. Obviously, the defendant doesn't think it's as persuasive as we do, but it's factually similar. I think rather than being sort of, it's an example, I guess, of how this issue should be addressed to me. Court of Appeals exhibited appropriate deference to the trial court's conclusion because it's an abuse of discretion standard of review. I don't really, you know, have too much to add beyond that on the federal court issue part. I don't think we necessarily even need to look to the federal courts. I feel like our approaches have diverged. There are several differences, as I pointed out in the brief. I also disagree that Kula is in any way applicable to this case. That is the clearest way to approach it. They're completely different procedural postures. For one thing, the Kula-Brown line of cases is premised on state misconduct. There's no misconduct here. Those were in the context of failure to disclose information, of questions about discovery violations. The purpose behind, I think, 29-19-12 and the statutory scheme is to ensure sort of a, basically a fair trial, to give all the evidence to the defendant that he's entitled to, put him on equal footing. That's not even relevant in this particular case. He's pled. He's found guilty. There's no fairness for trial. So how you're preparing for trial is irrelevant to the inquiry to me in the fair and just reason standard. And again, I don't think it's that the court didn't believe that this were true. It's that even if it were true, based on the record before it, didn't do anything for Carr. And that's essentially, I think, what the district court said is, this isn't helpful to you. And because it's not helpful to you, there's no way it can be a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea. I would agree with Your Honor that first standard, or the defendant's standard, basically of potentially exculpatory, is essentially an automatic withdrawal of a felony, a plea at any time. A defendant can at any time, I would submit, basically get, hey, inmate, buddy of mine, will you please do an affidavit for me? And if we're not going to evaluate that, it's essentially an automatic withdrawal every time. And I don't think that that's appropriate. It's not in keeping with this court's case law that it's a serious deal to plead. That's not an automatic withdrawal, and that you have to show a fair and just reason. I don't think you can, the district court has any way of getting around evaluating that type of evidence in some manner to determine whether a fair and just reason has been made. As far as the prejudice part, my understanding is that, again, the record isn't particularly great on, you know, cooperation agreements or anything of that nature. The evidence at the hearing was that basically the majority, if not all, of these cooperating witnesses had been sentenced. Not exactly sure how you would start over, particularly if the convictions are final, or say he appeals, one of the cooperating witnesses appeals. Do we have to get that guy to dismiss his appeal to then reinstate the charges? You know, and even if, let's say, you know, he pled down to a lesser included or a lesser, less serious offense, he gets hammered at sentencing, well, you know, he may not have any incentive anymore. Because what's the point of me cooperating if I'm just going to get hammered either way? So the fact that they've been sentenced, I think, is sufficient prejudice. I guess I don't have anything more to add unless there are questions from the court. I would submit it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.